perception, concepts, and logic. By the middle of the century, the dominant conclusion about perception was that it is theory-laden. The biggest names in the philosophy of science, Otto Neurath, Karl Popper, Norwood Hansen, Paul Feyerabend, Thomas Kuhn, and W.V.O. Quine, despite wide variations in their versions of analytic philosophy, all argued that our theories largely dictate what we will see. Putting their point in Kant's original language, our perceptual intuitions do not conform to objects, but rather our intuition conforms to what our faculty of knowledge supplies from itself. This conclusion about perception is devastating for science. If our percepts are theory-laden, then perception is hardly a neutral and independent check upon our theorizing. If our conceptual structures shape our observations as much as vice versa, then we are stuck inside a subjective system with no direct access to reality. Similarly, by the middle of the century, the mainstream conclusion about concepts and the propositions of logic and mathematics was that they are conventional. Most of the logical positivists started by agreeing with Hume and Kant that logical and mathematical propositions are analytic or a priori and necessary. On this account, twice two makes four, for example, has to be true, and we can determine its truth without appeal to experience, simply by analyzing the meanings of its constituent concepts. Such a proposition contrasts with one such as, Beverly's car is white. That Beverly's car is white is synthetic. Neither car nor white is contained in the other concept's meaning, so the connection between the two has to be established by experience, and the established connection between them is merely contingent. The car could have been painted any other color. This standard Humean-Kantian dichotomy of analytic and synthetic propositions immediately yields a very problematic implication. Logical and mathematical propositions are disconnected from experiential reality. Propositions about the world of experience, such as Beverly's car is white, are never necessarily true, and propositions of logic and mathematics, such as twice two makes four, being necessarily true, must not be about the world of experience. Logical and mathematical propositions, wrote Schlick, quote, do not deal with any facts, but only with the symbols by means of which the facts are expressed, unquote. Logic and mathematics, accordingly, tell us absolutely nothing about the experiential world of facts. As Wittgenstein put it succinctly in the Tractatus, quote, all propositions of logic say the same thing, that is, nothing, unquote. Logic and mathematics, then, are on their way to becoming mere games of symbolic manipulation. Such conclusions about logic and mathematics are devastating for science. If logic and mathematics are divorced from experiential reality, then the rules of logic and mathematics hardly say anything about that reality. The implication is that logical or mathematical proof cuts no ice in adjudicating competing claims of fact. Analytic propositions are, quote, entirely devoid of factual content, and it is for this reason that no experience can confute them, unquote. Offering logical proofs about real matters of fact is thus pointless. And, conversely, it is pointless to expect that any amount of factual evidence to add up to a necessary or universal conclusion. Accepting that the propositions of logic and mathematics are not based in experiential reality, and so do not tell us anything about that reality, leads one to the question of where logic and mathematics come from. If they have no objective source, then their source must be subjective. Two broad options emerged at this point within analytic philosophy. The neo-Kantian option, emphasized by the nativists and the coherence theorists, held that the basic propositions of logic and mathematics are innate in us, or necessarily emerge psychologically once we start to use words. And some such neo-Kantians scandalized the purer Kantians by holding out the hope that such innate or emergent propositions reflect or represent in some way an external reality. But, critics always asked, given the theory-ladenness of perception, how would we establish that such a connection exists? Any belief in a connection between reality and subjectively generated logic could only be reached by a leap of faith. It was the neo-Humean option, therefore, emphasized by pragmatists such as Quine, Nelson Goodman, and Ernest Nagel, that prevailed. On this account, Logical and mathematical propositions are merely a function of how we have decided to use words and which combinations of words we have decided to privilege. Concepts are merely nominal, based on subjective human choices about how to carve up the flow of phenomenal experience. Conceptual relativism follows directly from such nominalism. We could have decided differently what concepts to adopt. We could have and still could carve the world up differently. We could, for example, decide not to pick out one section of the color spectrum and call it blue, and call the neighboring section green, but rather pick an overlap area between them and, borrowing words from Goodman for a slightly different purpose, call it either GRU or BLEEN. That's a matter of convention. If all concepts are nominal, then one consequence is that there is no basis for a distinction between analytic and synthetic propositions. All propositions then become a posteriori and merely contingent. Logical relativism is the next consequence. Logical principles are constructs of concepts. What counts as a principle of logic, then, is not dictated by reality, but is rather up to us. Quote, "The principles of logic and mathematics are true universally simply because we never allow them to be anything else." Unquote. Logical principles become a matter of which formulations we are, quote, willing, unquote, to accept, depending on whether or not we like the consequences of accepting any given principle. Logical justification, Rorty wrote of Quine's doctrine, quote, "is not a matter of a special relation between ideas or words and objects, but of conversation, of social practice," unquote. But what if someone does not like the consequences of adopting a given logical principle? What if conversational or social practices change? If the rules of language and logic are conventional, what is to stop someone, from whatever reason, from adopting different conventions? Absolutely nothing. The rules of logic and grammar then can be as variable as other conventions, such as performing greeting rituals by shaking hands, hugging, or rubbing noses. No form of greeting or system of logic then is more objectively right than any other. By the 1950s, these conclusions were commonplace. Language and logic were seen as conventional, internal systems, and not as objective, reality-based tools of consciousness.